Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
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 Kapati pratamam garbham.
Kapati pratamam garbham.
Nanti kala agate,
nanti kala agate,
andani susuve nide,
andani susuve nide,
swapatyu sanidosati,
swapatyu sanidosati.
Kapoti,
kapoti,
the female pigeon.
Gatamam,
her first.
Garbham,
pregnancy.
Grinnante,
carrying.
Carrying.
So you can see it's a time for great celebration in the family. She's having her first child. Kale,
Kale.
When the time.
When the time.
For delivery.
For
Agate,
Agate.
Had come.
Had come.
Andani,
Andani,
ex,
ex,
Sushuve,
Sushuve,
she delivered,
she delivered,
Nide,
Nide,
in the nest,
in the nest,
Swapatyu,
Swapatyu,
of her husband,
of her husband,
Sanido,
Sanido,
in the presence,
in the presence.
So she's giving birth and her husband's there watching. And it actually is described in the third canto how this actually increases the bonds of affection when the husband actually witnesses the childbirth. Sati,
Sati,
the chaste.
The chaste.
The translation. Then the female pigeon experienced her first pregnancy. So we're thinking that this story started, I think, about verse 53, about these two pigeons. And it's a very interesting allegorical story. It actually goes to the end of the chapter. So this chapter, I think, is about 73 verses or so. And, 74 verses. So, the last, third of the chapter is this one story. So, as we understand, King Yadu has met this Avadhut Brahman, and the Avadhut Brahman is discussing his 24 gurus, or 24 persons, or 24 things that he's found inspiring. And it's a very interesting segment of the Bhagavatam, because traditionally we see, people take shelter of the Siksha Guru, Diksha Guru, Vatna Pradakshana Guru. Generally we find with devotees newer in devotional service, they just tend to focus on the Diksha Guru and think that's the be-all and end-all of life. Yet we see here how this Avadhut is describing to Yadu Maharaj that actually he's taking instruction from so many persons. And we see, as we go through here, he doesn't mention his Diksha Guru. Not once. There's no mention of him. He's mentioning things in nature, he's mentioning other living entities. In this chapter here, he covers 8 different gurus. Can anyone remember the different gurus?
Fire.
Fire.
Sky.
Fire, earth, sky. Wind.
Water.
Water.
Mountain.
Mountain was part of what?
Tree
was part of?
Nature.
Earth. Because earth was described as mountain and tree. Because the tree grows on the earth, the mountain is nothing but a manifestation of earth. So he's describing these 8 different gurus, and he's showing how he learnt so much from each of these, and we see that the qualities that a sadhu is carrying or manifesting. It's just like Kapila Devi, he says that. Tikshva Purunika Sudhira Sabad Ajita Shapla Sadhava Sabhushana. So you know what Bhushan means? It's just like we decorate the deities with Bhushan, ornaments. There's so many, the sadhu has, he's decorated with all the ornaments that are given. Sadhava Sabhushana. So he's decorated with all the saintly ornaments that are described in the scriptures. So we see here in this section, he's describing where he's gained the inspiration for these busha, these ornaments. And he starts off, I made a list of them because I can't remember them all, so. He starts off with the earth, so if you remember what he learned from the earth? Tolerance. Because, you see, what's the nature of the earth? It's just like we see people digging holes in the earth, they're drilling down, they're doing so many, you know, gigantic things, they're digging out and taking dirt and drilling holes and putting fences and making explosions, all different types of things. And the earth tolerates. Very, very tolerant. What else? What about the mountain? Because the mountain is one of the manifestations of it. What did the sadhu learn from the mountain? What's the nature of the mountain? What comes from the mountain? Huh? No, the mountain provides the necessities, because all the minerals come from the mountain. The minerals, when it rains, are washed down to the streams to fertilize the fields. So the mountain's providing so many things. And the tree? What about the tree? Yeah, the tree's also providing things. And actually, in the verses, it describes how the mountain's existence is simply for the benefit of others. And the tree is also providing. But what's another feature of the tree? Described by Lord Chaitanya. Tororiba Sahishuna. Tolerates. You know, the dog comes and urinates on the tree. And what does the tree do? Nothing. Just tolerates. The sun's beating down. The cold wind is blowing. You know? The tree just tolerates. So also, completely tolerating. And then from the wind, he described two aspects of the wind. From the vital air, the prana within the body, what did he learn?
It takes all kind of, either it is a perfume or good smell or bad smell.
No, this is a different type of air. That's the external. We're talking about prana. There's five airs within the body. Does anyone know the airs? Apana, Vijana, Uddana is the one that pushes down. When the child's being born, this Uddana pushes down, which causes the child to come out. Samana. I said Vijana. I can't remember. It's in the Gita, I think it's the 10th chapter of the Gita that it's described. So these airs, they circulate in the body. This is actually what's maintaining the body, is the life airs. And from that, he learned how to be satisfied with the simple maintenance of the body without endeavouring for sense gratification. Like Prabhupada would sometimes say, just do whatever is necessary to maintain body and soul together. We don't make these unnecessary arrangements. Like you see, like I know a gentleman up the road here. He's a nice man. He's a builder. And he's working on this house in Toorak, which he has been working on since last year, and he said it's going to take at least until middle of next year to finish. So you can just imagine how big and fancy a house is if it takes that long. Average house takes like 2 months to build. You know? But this house is taking, you know, probably 2 years to build. So you can understand it's a massive over-endeavour. And what is the result of the over-endeavour? Huh? Sneha, attachment. And this is what this discussion of the pigeons about, is this atisneha, this excessive attachment to material things. So when we make this unnecessary endeavour for maintaining body and soul, we become attached. We just do whatever is necessary to keep body and soul together. For what purpose? To serve Krishna. That's our purpose of life, is to serve Krishna. So this is what he learned from the wind. But also, just to care for the material body in such a way that our higher knowledge is not corrupted or perverted or polluted. Just like Prabhupada would say, simple living, higher thinking. Right? Because if we're so much caught up in trying to maintain an elaborate lifestyle, then our energy is put into the knowledge that's required to maintain that lifestyle. And it's very complicated. You know, you look at how things are going in this world, it's becoming more and more and more complicated every day. Any facet of life you can look at, you know, a simple thing like having a mobile phone, it's so complicated, especially in India. Isn't it? Remember what you had to go through to get your mobile phone this year? Unbelievable. I had to go to the phone office about 10 or 15 times just to get a simple thing like a SIM card that worked. So if you want to get frustrated with material life, just spend some time in India. Completely frustrated with material life, because it just doesn't work, you know. But if you want to enjoy spiritual life, then India is the ideal place. So you can get the best of both there, I think. But in the West, it's kind of a little bit difficult because here, because the whole culture is focused on this material development, this economic development, then, you know, it flows a little bit easier. Yeah? But you'll find as Kali Yuga progresses, it's going to get more and more difficult. Prabhupada often describes how, you know, like he was talking about, this lecture I was listening to a few days ago, he was talking about how you could buy rice at that time for 3 rupees a kilogram. But now, what's the price? 30, 40 rupees a kilogram for nice rice. I remember when I was a child, my parents used to buy, you know, these large Hessian sacks, I think about this big, weighed about 100 pounds or something, of potatoes. You know how much they paid for it? 20 cents. Yeah, and that was quite normal. People would buy sacks of potatoes and just keep them in a dark place and they were fine. 20 cents. How much do you pay for that many potatoes now? Is it $2, $3, $4 a kilogram? Yeah. So Prabhupada was saying, he's saying, because what's going to happen is all the things that are sattvic, right, are going to become more and more difficult to get. Things like milk, sugar, wheat, fruit, vegetables. These are sattvic things. As the age becomes more passionate and then degrades into ignorance, they're going to become more and more difficult to get. And Prabhupada was saying, as Kali Yuga progresses, you'll have 300,000 rupees. You won't even be able to buy a kilo of rice. And we're starting to be experiencing that now with food shortages. You know, who's had the experience? It's like you can't just go to one supermarket now and buy everything in one supermarket. You've got to go and shop around. You can't buy all the things you want in one place. It's getting more and more difficult. And as Kali Yuga progresses, this is going to become more and more prevalent. But if you want to buy technology, very simple. They make it so easy, it's getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper to buy technology. But food is getting more and more expensive. It's so backwards. Like Prabhupada often talks in Vrindavan, he's giving classes in Vrindavan. At the time when he was going to Vrindavan, they had just opened this Goodyear tyre factory up. You know, I think it's in Haryana, north of Faridabad. There's a big Goodyear tyre factory there. And he talks about how, you know, there's thousands of people coming every day from the village. They've given up growing, you know, the grains, etc., in the village, and they're working in Goodyear tyre factories so they can get money for sense gratification. But Prabhupada points out, you can't eat tyres. You can't eat technology. You know? You can't eat any of these things. You can't become satisfied by these things. Yet they're putting so much endeavour into it. And we're finding that the technology becomes more and more readily available, and the necessities of life, the things we need to survive, are becoming more and more difficult to get and more expensive. And this is how life is going. It's just going to get worse and worse like that. You know? Especially in the cities. You know, there was like, just some time ago, there was a big fear that, you know, there was going to be a food shortage. And they're all thinking about, well, how much food do they have in a place like Melbourne? How long would the food last if there was no food? You know, how long would it last? I think they said 48 hours or 72 hours. Mm-hmm. Then what? Just look out if you've got a vegetable garden. You'll be under siege from all sorts of people. So then, that was from the external, the internal wind, but from what did you learn from the external wind? What's the nature of wind? Yeah, it blows all over the place and it doesn't mix, it doesn't become contaminated. Like it'll blow over a stool field, it'll pick up that smell, it'll blow over a rose and pick up that smell. Just like, you know, you walk past the jasmine, there's jasmine vines growing all around you, you walk past the jasmine, you see lovely aroma which the air is carrying to us. So he learned that, how not to be affected, how to be within this body but not of this body, as Prabhupada would say, be in the world but not of the world. Don't become affected by the world. So he's saying and that's like, because, you know, as it's described, he's a beautiful young man, very very handsome, attractive features, you know? And for someone in this condition, or this you know, an attractive young body, it's not very difficult to get sense gratification. It's actually very easy because others also find that body attractive. Yeah? Yet, you know, he's taken on this mood of the wind, where he's not affected by the things that are going on around him. Yet we see that we're all affected by what goes on around us. We're living in this city. Just like, you know, my wife and myself came back from Mayapur about 3 weeks ago. And we noticed the difference from being in Mayapur, how it's such a peaceful place. You know, it's out in the country, so it's much more affected by the mode of goodness. Although even we find in India, the country's becoming more and more passionate. Same thing here, the country's becoming more and more passionate. Yet when we came back to a city like Melbourne, because predominantly passion and ignorance are pervading the atmosphere here, and we noticed we became affected. And that happens to all of us, is when we become influenced by these, or become in contact, as Krishna describes in the Gita, when the living entity comes into contact with the mode of passion, then the different features manifest. So we find that is when we come into contact with these things, then we become affected. Yet we see a self-realized person is never affected because he understands he's not the body. So this is also an indication that we're seeing ourselves as the bodies, because when we come into contact with various things like this, we become influenced. And Prabhupada gave a very interesting example in a lecture. He was talking about how people become influenced by the body. He said, just like, you know, if you get into a sports car and you drive a sport, well, he was actually saying a very, very nice car, like a Rolls Royce, you think you're something special because you're driving a fancy car. But if you drive an old beaten up car, it's kind of like, you don't think so, you're so wonderful. You know, if you drive a sports car, you know, isn't it amazing when someone gets in a sports car or a fast motorbike, all of a sudden they've got a lead foot and they're going really fast. Because they become influenced by that mode of nature. So in the same way in the body, we become influenced. Then the next one was the sky. What did you learn from the sky? Anyone know? What did he learn from the sky? What's the nature of the sky? What's the nature of the sky?
It's all pervading.
All pervading. It's everywhere. So what else is also everywhere? Sarvakata, Krishna says in the Gita. The soul. What else? The super soul. So the soul and the super soul, they're everywhere, but they're indivisible. They're unchangeable. You see how the sadhu, in everything in nature, in everything in existence, he sees a lesson in Krishna consciousness. This is the nature of a saintly person. Just like one time, you know, reporters were asking Srila Prabhupada about, you know, how he saw Krishna. And then this devotee started to, you know, go into some big, long, verbose explanation about how the great personality sees Krishna. And the Prabhupada said, no, not like that. He explained how the great devotee sees Krishna in everything. He sees how everything is Krishna's energy, how everything is connected with Krishna. And I remember when I joined ISKCON, that, you know, it wasn't like, you know, can you clean the floor? It was always, can you clean Krishna's floor? Can you wash Krishna's pots? Can you do this for Krishna? Can you do that? Everything was connected. But I think, you know, out of laziness or forgetfulness, we just, you know, tend to gloss over things like that. But it is useful for us to think like that, to try to remember how everything is actually connected to Krishna. And not just, you know, out of expediency try to avoid that. I think it's helpful. So then with the water, he learned how to be clear and purifying, because that's the nature of water in its pure state. But there was another really interesting lesson that he got from water. What was that? Anyone remember? Like, you know, when you go to a river or a stream and you hear the river, the water, the sound of the water, what's it like? It's very pleasing. Very pleasing sound. Just like, you know, fountains. You go to temples and stuff, and some temples have fountains. It's a very, very nice, pleasing sound. So what's the sadhu's nature there?
What he speaks nicely.
What does he speak about? You're a very nice person, I like you very much. You know, say some nice words and get some donation. No, he's always chanting about Krishna. He's always vibrating the transcendental sound, which is the most pleasing thing to the heart. And actually, in the second chapter of the Bhagavad, of the first canto of the Bhagavatam, it's talking about how this was it, Vasudeva Gataru Chi? This is actually the goal, is to achieve this taste for talking about Krishna, is Vasudeva Gataru, to always be vibrating about Krishna. Same thing is given in the Gita. It talks about how, how the devotees say derive great satisfaction and bliss by always enlightening one another and conversing about Krishna. This is the nature of a great devotee, is they're always looking to talk about the Lord. There's never a moment where they're not talking about Krishna. And so this is one of the other, I found this particularly interesting about the water. And then in the fire, he learned how to be devour all things without becoming dirty or contaminated and not being affected by inauspicious things. Then the moon, he learned how the material body undergoes growth and dwindling. We see the moon waxes and wanes. And so it's described in the Shastra how there's six changes the body goes through. There's birth, there's growth, there's maintenance, byproducts, dwindling and vanishing. Every animate object goes through those same things. Whereas inanimate objects, they don't go through the same things. They're just produced, they remain, they dwindle, they vanish. But everything animate, see, this is evidence of the soul. Everything animate does that. It grows and it produces byproducts. I mean, you could say that if I broke this up, there'd be byproducts because all the splinters on the floor, but not. You couldn't really classify that as byproducts. That would be dwindling because it's decaying. So everything animate goes through those different things. And he learned that from the moon. It's quite amazing the lessons he learned. Then the next one was? What's the other eye of the Lord?
Sun.
It says in the Gita how the sun and the moon are the two eyes of the Lord. So then he learned how to avoid entanglement even while coming into contact with the sense objects. And we see, what's the nature of the sun? There's a particular adjective that... Yeah, but what's the adjective that's often used in relation to the sun? Prophylactic. It means that it can purify something without itself becoming contaminated. So, traditionally in India, there would be school fields. Of course, nowadays they just do it anywhere and everywhere. I had an experience 2 years ago, I was in Calcutta, and we parked the car in the car park along the side of the road, and I got out of the car and stood in something. And I looked down and realized what it was. It was very unpleasant. I just couldn't find water fast enough to just like douse my foot. I was like, oh God. Really pastel anywhere and everywhere in India. Yeah. No discrimination. But traditionally, when they were following cultured society, they would pass in a stool field. And the stool field was out in the open. They didn't do it under a tree or anything. It was out in the open. Two arrow shots from the house. It wasn't right next door to the house. Like some people just step outside and just do it, because it's convenient. Two arrow shots from the house, a certain distance from rivers, a certain distance from the town, etc. like that. And it'd be out in the open, so when the sun would rise during the day, it would shine down, and the heat of the sun would dry it up and purify that area. But interesting also, another side comment, because we've just been going through some stomach problems. So I went to the doctors and got various tests done and stuff like that, and found out that I had a couple of bacteria. These bacteria come from stool contaminated water. So you may think, well, how do you get that? Well, there's two ways, particularly in a country like India, you're going to get that. All the water you drink in India is groundwater. It comes out of the ground. So nowadays, because they don't care where they pass stool, they pass right near where the well is. So what happens when it rains, and it's actually something to keep in mind, is if you're in India and it's raining a lot and there's water on the ground, be very, very clean, because all this contamination is coming out of the ground. And if you've got cuts on your feet and things like that, then you can get that into your body. So that's one way. So you have to be very careful about what water you drink in India. Another thing is that, as we understand in India, that people don't use toilet paper. They wash their, use their hands and wash them. So people aren't cleaning their hands properly. And the same thing happens here also. People don't clean their hands properly after going to the bathroom. Therefore, that gets into the food. Therefore, you get that into your body, you get sick. So cleanliness is very important. And we see as Kali Yuga progresses, again, cleanliness is dwindling. So these things we need to be very, very careful of. Then, he learned that from the sun. And now we get on to the story of the pigeon, which is a really interesting story. And as I was saying before, one third of this chapter is about this pigeon. All the other seven gurus that are discussed in this chapter, there's eight gurus discussed in this chapter, the other seven are either one, two, or three verses, whereas this one here is over 20 verses, 22 verses he's discussing about this pigeon. And one of the reasons that he does give so much information or discuss this topic so much is that because this, as is described in the first verse, about this atisneha, this excessive attachment for wife, family, etc. This is so prominent in this world. There's that verse in the Bhagavatam where it talks about kalatradishu, about how he talks about how they see that the land of birth as being worshipable, how they see the kinsman as one's own. Prabhupada would talk about this Svajana when he was giving those classes on Samadrona. Ashvatthama. When he was trying to destroy Maharaj Parikshit with the Brahmastra, then there's this word there in one of the verses, Svajana. So Prabhupada elaborates on this, our own people. He elaborates on this is based on this bodily concept of life. And in many classes he gave, he gave a lot of discussion on this word Svajana. So we see that here, this pigeon is in an ideal, what he considers an ideal situation. And out in the pot shed, you see the pigeons that come, they look so niggardly and just they've got lice and this thing and that thing, they look very unclean, very skinny, not cared for. But they're thinking, and this is the position of every single living entity. You may think that your position is really nice and their position is not so good, but they're thinking exactly the same as you are, that I've got a nice position. Kapila Dev points this out, that every living entity, no matter what species of life he finds himself in, finds a particular kind of satisfaction in that species and is never averse to being situated in such a body. So it doesn't matter whether it's a worm in stool, whether it's an amoeba inside your stomach causing a great amount of trouble, or is it a demigod on the heavenly planets. They're thinking that this is the ideal situation. Prabhupada explains that when Indra became a pig and Lord Brahma, he went down there to ask him to come back to heavenly planets. He said, no, I can't leave here. I've got so much responsibility. I've got a beautiful wife. I've got beautiful children. And this is what's happening to this hunter. He's looking at his pigeon wife and he's thinking, she's so beautiful. And when the children are born, and it's describing in the previous verses how his wife had this way of manipulating him, with his smiles and sweet words, he would seduce him into doing whatever she wanted, and he became so attached that he just acted in any way his wife wanted. Is that any different from what an attached person is doing with his partner? Is it any different? It's exactly the same thing. And we see as this story unfolds how he becomes more and more engrossed in the family situation. And it's interesting, this type of story appears several times throughout the Bhagavatam. There's a story that's quoted in one of the earlier verses, I think in verse 52, 53, something like that. About Yamaraj tells a story to the mourning wives of King Suyagya about the same kind of situation. There's also the story that Narad Muni tells to King Prachinabahisha about Paranjana and how Paranjana comes upon this beautiful woman. I mean, you read the description that it's like really intoxicatingly beautiful woman, and she's dressed in such a way that he can see various aspects of her body and things like that. She's trying to playfully cover up and his mind becomes so attracted. And it's a nice allegorical story because he talks about there's a five-footed serpent which from memory represents the life heirs. And there's 11 friends, which represent the mind and the working senses and the knowledge acquiring senses and so many different things, this allegorical story he's using. And then he goes through this whole story and describes how that, I think it's Chandravega, attacks the city of nine gates, which is where Paranjan and this beautiful woman live, and how they're defeated and you know, it's just the whole thing he goes through. And it's an allegorical story describing how the body becomes, because Chandravega represents old age, and how the body becomes attacked by old age, and then finally the serpent leaves the city and all this type of stuff, indicating how you know, we get old, we die, but still the attachments, they bind us up. And there's another interesting story, I can't remember who it is, about the he-goat and the she-goat. You remember that story, eh?
Yeah.
Yayati. Same thing. These allegorical stories are told because when we're directly confronted with our sort of difficult position or our foolish position in this material world, we find it difficult to understand, we find it difficult to relate to, or the false ego pushes us to think, no, it's not like that. But as soon as we hear these allegorical stories, we see Narad Muni is often speaks in this way. He speaks these allegorical stories in order to instruct people. He's a very, very merciful person. Again, if we go back to the earth, very charitable, always looking to give to others, always looking for the welfare of others. This is exactly the nature of Narad Muni. He spends his whole life just travelling around, trying to deliver people. And so he tells these allegorical stories. And in his story to King Prachinabahishat, because King Prachinabahishat was engaged in performing fruitive activities, even though his sons had gone out and they were all doing, you know, austerities to gain knowledge and, you know, spiritual understanding, he was engaged in fruitive activities. So Narad Muni saw this, he took compassion upon him, and he told him this story. Yeah. So in the same way we see here, this story, it's an allegorical story about a pigeon, where in Krishna is instructing Uddhava how to, you know, or actually if we take it one step ahead, is the Avadhut Brahmana is instructing the king, and in all these different ways he's instructing the king, you know, well, I learned this, I learned that. He's not saying, well, you have to do this and you have to do that, because, you know, oftentimes what happens is the false ego rears up, and that blocks us. It blocks us in so many ways. Just like my wife was telling me, she had a dream the other night, and in this dream she was reciting the Sringa Stotra, wasn't it? Which she doesn't know the prayer. She's read it, but doesn't know the prayer. But actually, we do know the prayer. All this knowledge is there within the heart. The Vedas are there within the heart. But the false ego blocks it. Our false bodily concept of life blocks it. So we see that with all these understandings, this information is there. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prem Sadakavanaya Shavana Disutya Karanayudai. It's awoken by the process of devotional. So it's there. Nitya Siddha Sadakavanaya. It's there in the heart. But through the process of devotional service, this natural love is awoken. This knowledge of Krishna is awoken through the process of devotional service. And the knowledge, the process of devotional service erodes the false ego. And that's what's binding us up in this world, is we have this false concept of who I am. We have this false concept of my duty, my this, my that, I'm this, I'm that. All these different parties. These false concepts of, you know, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm Australian, I'm American, I'm Indian, I'm whatever. I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer. All these false identifications that just block us from our natural position of being a servant of Krishna. This is who we are. This is our real identification. There's nothing else for us. I am a servant of Krishna. Yet we see in this world, because we become caught up in this idea of enjoyment, because the nature is to enjoy, anandamoyajasa. That's the nature of the jiva. Yet we have this false concept of how to enjoy. And we have so much advertising, so many people pushing us, you know, keep up with the Joneses, all this kind of stuff, just pushing us with this polluted idea of how to enjoy. Right? And we pursue this, and we get caught up in this whole situation of working very, very hard to try to get enjoyment. But this is not what human life is for. Human life is about understanding. Tapo divyam putra ke yena shatvam. You know, there is some degree of hard work. There has to be tapa. But what are you performing that tapa for? Are you performing tapa to get sense gratification? Or do you perform tapa for realization of God? When we perform this tapa, tapasya, for sense gratification, it brings about misery. This is the result of these material austerities, is misery. And we see so much misery in this world. This is interesting. It's in Sanskrit grammar, this is called the varga. I was just discussing with Prabhu this morning about the different vargas. There's five vargas in Sanskrit grammar. So one varga called pavarga. Prabhupada describes this 20-something different places in his lectures and stuff. And particularly in the classes he gives on 129, this Dharma Shahi Apavarga Shah. Very interesting. He's talking about how this dharma brings about apavargasya. So apavargasya means freedom from these miseries, or ultimately liberation. He says dharma means liberation, means to be on the path of liberation. So these pavargas, the vargas, they have all these, they call dhatus, aren't they? There's, what is it? Pa, pa, ma. Are they called dhatus or just varnas? Okay, that makes something else fit in there. Varnas. So they have these words, and just like so, there's pa, that's pa, which means hard work. And we're working hard, parishram, working hard to achieve what we want. Then there's pa, pha, which means pena, or foaming. Foam comes from mouth because we're working very hard. Yeah? Just like you see in India sometimes, you'll see the ass or the donkey. You know, they're loaded up with bricks, and honestly, they've got these thin little legs, and the legs are kind of shaking as they're walking. If you put another brick on their back, their legs would break. They're so loaded up, you know. And then, that's that pa. Then there's ba. So ba means frustration. You're working so hard to get what you want, yet there's frustration. Then the next thing is bha, which means bhaya, or fear. You work hard, you achieve it, then you're worried someone will take it away. Yeah? Like Prabhupada, he gave the example of President Nixon. He worked so hard to become the President of the United States. He became frustrated, and he was fearful they would kick him out, which they did in the end. Yeah? Yeah? So fearful. And then we find, what is this fearing? Just like we see, what's that verse? This is something that's mostly associated with animals. Animals are in this fearful condition of life. Human beings aren't meant to be in a fearful condition of life because they should have faith that, you know, Krishna is taking care. But because we're struggling for this sense gratification, then fearful. Always fearful. Yeah? And then ultimately, what does it end in? Ma. Death. Mrityu. Death. Great, isn't it? Yeah. So much hard work performing. Very hard work. You see these people like they're working so hard, you know, to get, you know, just this little thing. These people labouring on this thing and that thing. They're working practically day and night just to feed their family. You know, foaming the mouth. They're getting frustrated. They're fearful about losing it. Fearful about, will I lose my job? Especially right now, you know, people are so fearful about losing their jobs. Yeah? And it's kind of interesting. They become so, and it's very similar to this story of the pigeon, with exactly what happens with this pigeon. They become so caught up in their material endeavours, trying to expand their material affluence, and they lose it. And what happens? They throw themselves from the top of a building. So foolish. They throw their life away because they've lost a little bit of money. They've lost, you know, their opulent position, their affluent position. They lose something, they throw their life away. Just like this foolish pigeon. He's seeing there. He's seeing. You'll see it come in the next few verses. That, you know, after the family comes, they're so attached and they're working hard. Same thing Prabhupada's describing here. This working hard, this path, working hard to get the food. They're going all over the forest, you know, to get the food. And even they're going out and getting the food in this beautiful environment, they're becoming more attached. Look, we've got everything so nice, this beautiful forest, the trees, you know, our lovely home. Becoming so attached. And then this hunter comes along, the cruel hunter. It's like Mah, death. The cruel hand of death. The cruel, Prabhupada would say, the stringent law of material nature. Doesn't look whether young boy, old man, nice person, bad person. Doesn't look. It's just the law is there. And it comes down. So they're working so hard and they become so attached to the material, the fruits of their material endeavor. Just like a Griha Maidi. Their whole life is about simply increasing their material facility to enjoy. And that's what's happening with these pigeons. They're just working so hard to increase their material facility to enjoy their life. And then what happens is the cruel hand of death, the hunter comes, catches the children, because they're just flying around the nest, you know, learning to fly, things like that. And the parents are so attached to the children. They come and they see the children. The mother, she immediately flies in to try and save the children. And she gets caught. Yeah? She's lost her intelligence. She's caught up in the senses, thinking that I can save the situation. An intelligent person would look at it and think, no, I can't do this. I can't save this situation. But she's, because of being caught up in the emotion, because of being caught up in the material attachment, she just runs in and immediately is caught. And then the father, he's standing there and he's also watching. He's just like mortified. He's just ready to give up his life practically. He's so affected because all his attachments are there, all his worldly attachments are there in front of him. The children are unconscious. His wife is flapping, trying to get out of the net. And he also loses his sense, and he's already lost his sense actually a long time ago because he's become so attached. Anyone who's attached in that way has lost their intelligence. If we become attached to material nature, we lose our intelligence, we lose our ability to discriminate between right and wrong. And we just act to try to satisfy our senses. So he also flies in and gets caught by the hunter. The hunter kills him, takes him home, cooks him up and eats him. That's it. That's what happens to these people in material life. They become so attached to the material facilities that they accrue from their hard work, the fruits of their labour. They think that they're the enjoyers of the fruits of their labour. But Krishna says, you're not entitled to the fruits of the results. If we act in a way to try to enjoy the fruits of our endeavour, we become attached. And from this attachment, we become caught up in the material whirlpool and we get sucked down. Maya has these two natures, these two energies. She has his Avaranatmika, which is the covering shakti, and the Prapekatmika throws you, actually no, it's the other way, Avaranatmika throws you down, Prapekatmika covers you over. So this is exactly what happens, we get pushed down from the position, because originally, Prabhupada says in that first record he did, originally living entities were all Krishna conscious. That's our nature. We're all originally Krishna conscious, but because we want to enjoy material nature, because we want to lord over material nature, we get pushed down and covered over. Just like, you know, sometimes Prabhupada would use this expression, bloop. Have you all heard this expression? Someone blooped. So, and he described, it's just like when you drop a stone into mud, the sound it makes goes bloop. Isn't it? Bloop. But what happens? You don't see anything. You don't even see where it went into the mud. Nothing. When you drop it into water, you get ripples and things like that, but when you drop it in the mud, it just disappears. You don't see anything. The same thing. When the living entity falls from that Krishna conscious position, they just bloop. Gone. You don't see them. Covered over completely. So when we become bound up, when we become attached to our endeavors, just like Krishna explains, he says, Yatna tat kamano yata loko yam kamabandana tada tam kamakuntaya mukta sangha samashya. That work done as a sacrifice of Krishna must be performed. Otherwise, our works cause kamabandana. They will bind us in this world. So this is the only way. This is the only way. As said, dharma shahi apavarga sha. The only way to achieve this apavarga, this freedom from material misery, this freedom from the hard work, is by dharma, by religious activities. This is the duty of a human being. This is like, as it mentions in the last verse of this section, the human form of life is the doorway to liberation. This is the only way. You have to be in a human body to achieve liberation. You're one of the 400,000 species of human life. You have to have a human body to achieve liberation. So if we don't use the human form of life for that purpose, we're wasting the human form of life. Therefore, we don't deserve the human form of life. You know, all throughout the scriptures mentioned, Prahlada Maharaj mentions, you know, that verse which is used in the introduction well, not an introduction, but right at the beginning of the seventh canto. You know that verse? I've forgotten the Sanskrit. How one should use the human form of life from the tender age of childhood to practice. Thank you. Komana acharya prakyo dharmam bhagavatam iha. Indeed, this dharma bhagavatam, you must practice this dharma. Durvam manasam janma tadapi andruva martudam. This rare human form of life, it's so rare to get this human form of life, and it's meant for dharma. And this is the same thing in Hitopadesh. Prabhupada quoted that verse, Aharanidhavaitanam Maitanam Cha, so many times, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times he quoted that verse. The human form of life is meant for dharma. That's what it's about. That's why you have this body. You don't have it for any other purpose. It's not for expanding your influence in this world. It's not for increasing your sense gratification. It's for performing the activities of devotional service. Nothing more. Yeah? If we don't use it for that, it will be taken away. It's just like you give something to a child to play with. You give the child whatever, Maybe you give it a calculator or something, or maybe an iPod, and it starts using it for bashing nails in or something. What do? You take it from them. And you see children do that. You give them something, they start to bang at things with it, because they don't understand. They don't have knowledge. But the human form of life, you cultivate knowledge. You understand what life is for. And then use that life properly. Don't waste this human form of life. Any questions at all? It's a rare opportunity we have. Let's not waste it. In Rishabdev, this fifth canto, it's right in the first verse of the fifth canto, Rishabdev, he says, Nayam deho deha bhajam lok kastam karman aha devin bhujam ye. Vidbujamye, village animals, hogs and dogs which eat stool, Prabhupada translates that. He says, you've got this human form of life, you've been awarded. Prabhupada translates that verse, the living entity has been awarded this rare human form of life to cultivate the activities of devotions. And he says, kastan karman, it's not for hard work. This kastan means like difficulties. It's not a karman activity. It's performing these very difficult activities. Sense gratification is very difficult. And you're seeing more and more difficult. You have to have a lot of money to get sense gratification. Very difficult. And it's not meant for that. Kastan karman ahate vidbujami. The sense gratification is available for the village animals. They eat, they sleep, they mate, they defend. Samanyaneta pashubhiranama. But if you just do that, then samanyaneta. That's what you're saying is this. No different from an animal. So we need to use this human form of life to elevate ourselves beyond animal species, beyond animal birth, because if we don't, we are animals. So Rishabdev points out, he says, Tapo dibhyam putra yena shakam shudyad yashmat brahma sokhyam pranam. This tapo dibhyam, by which Brahman is realized. Perform this austerity, this divine austerity by which we realize Brahman, Krishna. That's what human form of life is for. I often get confused between Gadadhar Pandit and Gadadhar Das. Gadadhar Pandit, from my memory, is Srimati Radharani. Gadadhar Das is Srimati Radharani's effulgence. So, what can you say about Gadadhar Pandit? I got to dress him during when the deities were installed in Mayapur. That was pretty far out. What can I say? What can I say? He's manifestation of Srimati Radharani, one of the Panchatattva, members of the Panchatattva. Panchatattva Makam Krishna, Bhakta Rupa Surbhakam, Bhakta Vataram, Bhakta Kyam, Mami, Bhakta Shakti. Yeah, I didn't read up on it. I normally don't read up on pastimes. He's a member of the Panchatattva, and he's engaged in the whole Panchatattva is actually engaged in just propagating Krishna consciousness, understanding that this is what the human form of life is about. The human form of life is not meant for animal activity. The human form of life is meant to realize Krishna. So the Panchatattva, all the members of the Panchatattva were engaged in that activity. They were hearing and chanting the name of the Lord, telling others. Didn't Garada Panda take Chetra Sannyas in Puri? He stayed in Puri, I think.
Yeah, he wanted to go in
Puri.
Oh, he was told to take Chetra Sannyas, wasn't he?
No, he left. He left. He's not able to go when he left.
But he was supposed to stay there in Puri. Yeah. Any other questions?
He worshipped Tony Gopinath.
Huh?
He worshipped Tony Gopinath.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, very interesting story. Actually, have you seen the demon Tony Gopinath? It's quite tall, probably about 5 foot tall, but it used to be taller. Because when Garadhara Pandit got older, it was a Tota Gopinatha Gadadhara Pran, Jaya Tota Gopinatha Gadadhara Pran. That he used to worship Tota Gopinath, which is a deity not very far from Nairastapur Samadhi, just up the road a bit. Very beautiful deity. And actually, I was there one day watching them worship the Shalagrams, and just the way they were worshiping the Shalagrams, they were a little bit rough, you know, it was like putting the wig on. First time I ever saw a wig on a Shalagram. And the only time I've ever seen a wig on a Shalagram. Just like slaps the wig on top of the Shalagram. When Garadhara Pandit was very old, because he worshiped these deities for quite some time, when he was very old, he had osteoporosis and he couldn't stand up straight. Well, his body had osteoporosis, manifest osteoporosis, and he couldn't stand up straight. So he was going to stop worshipping Tota Gopinath. So Tota Gopinath sat down for him. And actually, that sometimes the Vajrayas will show you the cracks in Tota Gopinath's knees where he sat down, because stone, you know, when it sits down, might crack. So, yeah. And apparently Mahaprabhu entered into that deity of Tota Gopinath.
Well, that's the crack.
Well, there's different.
The point of that crack, so that's where Mahaprabhu.
There's different stories. Yeah. But also, there was a deity in South India where Mahaprabhu was seen entering into as well. You had a question, Roger? Okay. Anything else?
They are talking about men, the male pigeon watching the female delivering hands. What about females? We have to deliver, we have to take care of kids.
Yeah.
What about us? We get so attached. What about us?
Exactly. If we take this as being the be-all and end-all of life, then naturally we're going to become very attached. We have to focus on developing our Krishna consciousness. All of us, not just the men, the women also, everyone has to focus on that.
But we are fighting against our nature and our job.
But we're all fighting. Well, no, but
that's
not our nature. That's not our nature. That's the conditioning. Because, you know, you're in a woman's body, or someone's in a woman's body thinking that I'm a woman. I'm the mother of this child. But if we look at the story of Chitraketu, when he had that child, Harshashoka, and then the child was poisoned and died, and then Narad Muni and Angira Muni came along, and they saw the whole kingdom lamenting over this child. And it reminds me of a funny story that Prabhupada tells, also the story of Sargal Singh. Interesting story. I'll tell that one later. So the whole kingdom's lamenting about this child dying, and then so Narad Muni comes along and he brings the child back to life, and then the mother and father, they're like, oh, they come back to life when they see this child, you know, is alive again, and they start saying, oh my dear child, you know, and you know, how could you leave your mother and father, and they're going on, you know, like this to the child, and the child says, mother, father, which mother and father are you? I've had so many mothers and fathers. You know, so you may be mother and father now for these children, but they've had unlimited mothers and fathers. You've been, you know, so many times a mother, so many times a father, so many times a child. It's just transitory. It's just going from one body to the next, to the next, to the next. But this human form of life is the opportunity to stop that. You know, so we need to push against the tide, if you like, because the tide of Kali Yuga, the tide of the material energy, is pushing against us very hard. And you see that the natural thing is that everything decays in this world. The nature, it describes in the Gita, says achara, the nature which means to fall down. That's the nature of the living entity, is naturally to fall down. So naturally the living entity becomes affected by meat eating, intoxication, illicit sex, gambling, and all these things. We have to push against that. It's not that we can just sit on the fence and expect that we're going to, you know, become God conscious. Not that, you know, I've seen in Africa, you know, I was in, there used to be this video one time about Atosha Pan, the devotees, you know, was circulating around this one. I think the devotees bootlegged it, and they put a bit of a, you know, a story about the Bhagavad Gita in there as well, speaking about, you know, you know, how life and death in the material world sort of thing. But I actually went to Atosha Pan, you know, and we saw this pride of lions there. And it's exactly what Prabhupada says, you know, the lions are very lazy by nature, they just like to lie around all day. But even though they're the king of the jungle, the most powerful animal in the jungle, and, you know, et cetera, stuff like that, no animal walks into the mouth and says, please eat me. It just doesn't happen. Huh? So they have to get up and fight. They have to actually get up and eat, even though they're pretty lazy the way they hunt. They wait till an old animal comes along and they just jump up and kill it. But still, they have to perform some action. So in the same way, you know, we can't just expect to become God conscious. We actually have to work at it. And there's many things working against us, primarily our conditioning. So we need to work against that conditioning very, very hard. As it says, tapo dibyam, we have to perform austerity. It means hard work. But it's not as hard as the hard work that the materialists perform. So we have to work against this conditioning. We have to overcome the influence of material nature. And in that way, we can give up these material attachments. There's nothing wrong with being attached to devotees, because that can be liberating. Just like we see in the story of Ajamil. You know, he had named his child Narayan, which was actually a result of his past pious activity, because no one, you know, not an ordinary person cannot name their child after God. But because his child was named Narayan, and at the end of his life he remembered his child, by the arrangement of the Lord, he remembered his child to call out his name. Oh, Narayan! And immediately the Vishnu Dutas came and saved him. So there's nothing wrong with being attached to devotees, because this attachment also is liberating. But we see here, this is a completely material attachment, and this pigeon is simply enjoying, you know, the soft feathers of the babies and this thing and that thing. It's just, you know, I won't say. It's just unbelievable, you know. It is so. There's one story in the Bhagavatam how it talks about how materialistic people, how they see their children, and how their children become so worshipful. They even take their stool to be like chandan, and they want to ornament their foreheads with it. You know, that's their whole sort of the attachment causes them to see like that. But as devotees, we see differently. Well, at least we should see differently. We should understand that this is just a temporary situation I'm in, and, you know, through the process of devotional service, I'll be able to become liberated from this material situation. Anything else at all?
Could you tell us a little bit about Anzac Day from a Vedic perspective?
Anzac Day from a Vedic perspective? I remember years ago at school we did a play on Anzac Day, and it was so typical of... Was it Anzac Day today, is it?
Today.
Okay. Okay, another, you know, holy holiday. I remember this play, I can't remember what it was called. And it was about like a typical Australian scenario where, like, you know, the son was rebelling against the father. And the father would go out on Anzac Day and get rotten blind drunk and fall down in the gutter and embarrass everyone, you know. And that's what it's all about, is they're so caught up in this whole, at least that's my perception, you know. They're so caught up in this whole bodily thing, you know, how they died for the country and stuff like that. And what did they die for, really? Intoxication, illicit sex, gambling, meat eating. What are they, you know, was a noble cause that they were fighting? I think that's questionable. You know, I mean, my grandfather was, you know, he was in the First World War, he received injuries, you know, my grandfather, my father's side, which he later died from. You know, my wife's father was also, it was Coral Sea, wasn't it? was blown off the deck of a ship, and the kamikaze plane crashed into the plane. He was a captain on the ship and blew him off the ship. You know, and he died as a result of the injuries he received there later on. So, you know, we've all had the experience, but, you know, if we look at it from the Vedic point of view, then we have to question. I mean, obviously, there's certain morality, chivalrous behaviour involved, you know, because the soldiers are acting for what they believe to be noble cause and things like that. Yet, overall, we see that, you know, their motives, like the overall motives, are attachment to sense gratification, you know, expanding their material position, etc., etc., like that. Whereas, if we look at something like the Battle of Kurukshetra, or the battles that were fought, you know, at other times in the Vedic age. You know, Arjuna didn't want to fight because he was you know a noble person. He was very moral, etc. Like that. He didn't want to fight because he didn't want to kill his relatives. Yet Krishna told him to fight. Krishna demanded that he fight. And so the motives there were completely different. Therefore, it's described that all those who fought on the Battle of Kurukshetra, who were killed by Arjuna, seeing Krishna, went back to Godhead. They're all liberated. So I doubt that people who fought in these various wars were liberated from it.
Doesn't, like, because Krishna says that Yanti Deva Kripa Deva, Arjuna Yanti Kripa. So these qualities in worship
of the forefathers. Anzac Day, I guess that would fall into. Certainly to some extent, but what's their process of worship? Getting intoxicated? There needs to be, like, this is scriptural, right? So in order to achieve the results of these things, one needs to follow the Shastra. So how do you worship the forefathers? There's actually a description in the Shastra how to worship the forefathers, and it doesn't mean getting drunk and then falling on your face in the gutter. That's not worship. It's like the same with the Devas. There's specific rituals where one performs to worship the Devas. So, obviously their destination from such observances is not auspicious. It's not a liberating observance, and it's just wasting the human form of life. Okay? Thank you very much. Grantanara, Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki, Samaveta, Bhaktivedanta, Ki, Srila Prabhupada, Ki, Jai Nityai Gopi.